tomorrow. Ambassador College presents Garner Ted Armstrong, bringing you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greeting friends around the world, this is Garner Ted Armstrong with the good news of the world tomorrow, a worldwide research organization with the idea of ultimately deciding how you are going to react is now in existence, or at least is envisioned by a geneticist. His name is Dr. Dubeko, and he is of the Salk Institute for Biological Studies, and he told a group of science writers that the study of genetics, the mechanism by which living things grow and reproduce, has reached the stage where we must begin collecting and processing with computers this tremendous amount of new information and hopefully begin picking committees to decide what man should be like in the future. Now, not so long ago, I read a clipping on the World Tomorrow program from a science writer, syndicated columnist, I believe, nationwide in the United States at least. You may not have seen it in Great Britain. About how wifey could slip down to the corner chemist or drugstore and pick up a pill to slip into hubby's coffee in case she thought he was a little too grouchy this morning. And you know that hallucinogens and various mind and personality-altering drugs already do exist. And so now geneticists are saying it is foreseeable that science may be able to predetermine not only the physical characteristics, the height, the weight, shape, color, texture of your hair maybe of human beings, but also even the social attitudes of people. It may be possible eventually in the world tomorrow, they say, through direction of cell growth, to choose not only how many fingers a man ought to have, in case you would like to play the violin with a little more dexterity than you have been in the past, but even how he will think, whether he will be a war-loving or a war-hating creature. So, said this geneticist, we must start immediately setting up some great organization to collect the new genetic information, which now seems to make all this feasible. Well, now that's all very interesting, but it disgusts me a little bit because it makes me a little apprehensive about who's going to choose who is going to decide to do what to who. In other words, I wonder who is going to make up that great organization or great body who will decide about the height, shape, and weight of my future children, or of my grandchildren, or of me, for that matter, or of future generations which are yet to be born. You know, today the world seeks salvation through the false god of science. Medical scientists in particular warn people that they are expecting entirely too much out of scientists, that they expect answers for every question, solutions for every problem. And they're warning how millions of people live as though science had all the answers. Pills to make you well, pills to slim you down or to put on some fat, plastic organs when you wear out your own, vaccinations and shots, hallucinogens, drugs, operations, various therapeutic treatments. But medical science and no other science, including genetics, has all the answers, and it's about time you began to realize it. The really mammoth problems of today cannot be answered by science. Science can put a vast machine into an orbit around the Earth, a monstrous space vehicle, and even achieve a soft landing on the moon and accomplish spacewalks, or even put a tiny radio transmitter in your olive in the cocktail, or maybe your hollow tooth. But science can't figure out why the boy next door goes wrong, why it is children turn on and sometimes murder their parents. They can't tell you what causes race bias and hatred. They can't tell you why men war. They can't tell you what produces delinquency or criminality. As Dr. Robert M. Page said, so long as we have human nature, we will have wars. Now, historians are people who deal with the past in the light of the present and then try to chart some course for the future. You may or may not realize that many an historian, a sociologist, is invited as a special consultant to leaders or heads of state. That many historians in leading universities, principally back east, Harvard, Yale, and the like, are oftentimes asked opinions about the war in Vietnam, or about the course of foreign policy, or about policies involving domestic sociological change in big nations. And historians all, as if with unanimity, admit that the only way out of our present-day monstrous headaches, and they're so big it would take the next several years to describe them all, the population explosion, for example, mounting religious confusion, the racial discrimination and hatred, the really big and the deep-seated problems of the very nature of man. When they ask, what is the real answer to it all, they echo Dr. Robert Page's words, that so long as we have human nature, we will have wars. that human nature is the really big culprit on the world scene. Every last one of them admits. And so science today seeks to change human nature. So now this geneticist says the ultimate feasibility in genetics would be not only the changing of your height, shape, and weight, but the very changing of your nature. But the real worry about it all is who is to decide what is the right nature. Now, this geneticist said that they will set up some great organization to collect the information and find out how this could be feasible to begin altering human conduct so that they could decide that you would either be a war-loving or a war-hating creature. But now you run into a lot of problems there, because on the one hand, some philosophers and historians have preached that war is cleansing for the human soul, that war is glorious, that war is wonderful, that war is the testing of the moral fiber and strength of a nation. Oh, you can read a lot of philosophers like that in Germany, for example, where they say war is fantastic, it's marvelous and wonderful. The geopoliticians of Germany, led by Haushofer and Mackinder and others, who envisioned world conquest, just like those who live in Beijing today or Moscow, those of yesteryear who envisioned the conquering of all human societies by one other human society, said they were all for war, that war was natural. A nation was like any growing blob of matter, like an amoeba, that sprang into existence, it grew, it developed, it finally approached senility, and then it had to die and make way for some other blob of growing matter. And the way they reasoned in World War II, it was Germany's turn. So some people say war is moral, and some say war is immoral. Who is to decide what is right? What about right from wrong? When you enter a university classroom today, the professor will tell you he doesn't know. A good friend of mine registered for a class at a very well-known and large institution of 50,000 some odd students who were attending this university. He registered for a class entitled The Origin of Life. On his orientation class period, the one in which the professor was discussing how he was going to teach the class, the professor apologized that the class was called The Origin of Life, because he said, actually, I don't have any answers about the origin of life. Now, many a philosophy class is told that they're not going to learn any positive answers, that they're going to engage themselves in a lot of speculation, that they're going to wonder, they're going to question and postulate, but they probably won't come up with any real clear-cut conclusions by the time the year or the term is over. So who is to tell what is right from wrong if geneticists decide to alter your very nature? Who is to decide whether you're a grouch or a real pleasant fella? You know, some people say, you know, old Joe's a real easygoing guy, and somebody else probably hates him. Some people decide that one type of personality is desirable. They want to be the strong, silent type because they've been to too many movies. And so they're leaning against the door jamb with a toothpick in their ugly face, with a sort of a look on their face all the time, a sort of a pose or a certain posture with which they hope to go through life. They have all these daydreams in the back of their head. They're not really coming true. Nobody really thinks of them what they hope that people think of them, but they hope that people think it anyhow. And so people live in a pose. You've met people like that. And chances are you look at one every now and then when you shave if you're not careful, because that just is the way people are. But who is to decide what is a pleasant personality and what's a real grouchy personality? Who will you give the right to change your nature? Now, can you imagine this, if you have ever read any science fiction or seen a science fiction movie, that the ultimate end to which this would grow would be a world of shuffling, ungainly, grunting automatons, mindless creatures, laboring endlessly to produce perhaps material wealth and goods for just an elite few who have decided that these ungainly creatures should be kept subjugated for their own good. Just as docile as a group of dumb beasts like oxen or cattle of some type. And that's exactly what this geneticist really is suggesting when you stop to take it apart. Because when some other being, some other person, has the power by any means at his disposal, whether through genetics or whether through mind damaging, in often cases, drugs, to alter your very thought processes, the way you react to situations, your moral standards, your very personality, and your character, to do so by any means at his disposal, then that's where it's ultimately headed. Now, can you imagine a world of humans whose every action is predetermined by a group of geneticists or scientists or government leaders? How would those men decide what is right? Leaders in philosophy and education today tell you there aren't no such things as absolutes. There isn't anybody who can decide what is right and what is wrong. So how would they accomplish it? Now, you can, and I can show you what the source is, but a lot of people are a little confused on that subject. Would you subscribe to such a world as this? Would you applaud it and say this is a good thing? Would you gladly turn the key to the door of your mind over to a scientist? You've heard about a frontal lobotomy, haven't you? That's where they separate the skull and with a knife dip down into the brains of a human being and separate some nerve connections so that the frontal lobes of the brain are rendered inoperable so that you can still have memory and motor facility, you can still have reflex action and all that, but your willpower has been utterly and totally removed. And this has been done. Supposedly, and I know of no other way to describe it, only to people who have been violent, if that is the term to use, and of course that is decided by those who are supposedly over them once they're committed to an institution, and who are known to be violently or criminally insane. But be that as it may, that has been done to many a person because relatives wanted to put them away at an institution, and that's a fact, and we all know it. Have you seen some of the articles about some of the experiments that have been carried on by doctors without a patient's knowledge and without his permission? Did you read the article in a very leading and prominent weekly news magazine in the United States? Not one, but a couple of them now have come out with it, and all I'm doing is reporting what I've seen in black and white like the rest of you, where doctors by the dozens and hospitals by the score have been conducting such experimental operations where they've had group A and group B, and X percent in group B has died because they've deprived them of the very same treatment given to group A, or where nurses were told deliberately in a ward in a children's hospital not to wash their hands so they could determine whether or not this sort of grape-like cluster germ, Staphylococcus, is spread by nurses' hands if they're not clean enough. And sure enough, a certain large number of little innocent babies died. Oh, yes, it was all done in the name of medical science. Now, that means that to me, at least, if I ever do end up in a hospital, which I hope and pray is very, very unlikely, I'm going to be a little more suspicious of procedures than I might have been before I read that article. Let's at least put it that way. Many people, however, look at doctors, medical scientists, or scientists in general, as a sort of a substitute for God. They really do. They are willing to put their very lives and beings into the hand of another human being. Now, when it gets to your mind, in addition to just your body, that gets a little ticklish. That gets a little bit frightful. Would you ask a geneticist to change your personality? Would you want a group of experts to decide in advance the kind of person you will be and whether or not you will react to a certain situation with joy or whether a funny situation will make you cry? Maybe you would come out backward, you know. Maybe every normal impulse or emotion you should experience would be the exact opposite. You ought to think about that a while because that's exactly what they're proposing today. Now, horrifying pictures you can think of that this would lead to, in Dr. Dobeko's words, if this should ever come into being. But, of course, that is another solution for man's ills, they say, because the only way to make him stop warring, the only way to make him get rid of his racial bias is perhaps to change his very nature. So all of them say almost unanimously, at least if you're speaking of philosophers, historians, and government leaders, when they talk about the future history of man, if we are to survive as a human race and to avoid extinction, then we must have human nature changed. You may not realize there is a master plan for doing precisely that. But no one man is qualified to change the nature of any other man. No man or group of men is qualified to truly bear total rule, unquestioned rule, over other men. That certainly is the belief of anyone in a free society. They believe in a society of at least two parties and a lot of checks and balances and rule by the majority, who would have the preponderance of power to oust, to impeach, or to get rid of some one person in a minority who is imposing his own self-rule over the majority. At least, let's say, theoretically and ideally, that is the idea of the founding fathers of many nations on the earth today, principally, certainly, the United States of America. It looks like, when you look at it as a spectator once in a while, when one person in high office pretty well imposes his own ideas over other people by the multiple millions, and the entire sociological course of a nation is changed, the entire course of modern history in the world is changed, that doesn't always work just exactly ideally, but at any rate, that is the way it is supposed to work. But really, when you stop to think about it, because no man is out of reach of his own jealousy, because no human being is beyond his own ego, because no human being has been able to escape his own human nature, his vanity, lust, his greed, and his jealousy, that merely means he is by nature not qualified to bear total rule over any other creature. Only a superhuman being would have that qualification. Only someone who is beyond the reach of purely human reasoning, someone who is beyond the reach of human nature, someone who had so conquered human nature and overcome it that it literally had no hold upon him. And you don't know of any such creature, unless, that is, you know of God, unless you know of Christ, his Son. Now, even the mention of the name of God would incite a riot in some circles, I should imagine, today. The very mention of the name of Jesus Christ, oh, well, on a golf course or something like that, I suppose people wouldn't get too excited. A lot of times on a golf course, you think you're hearing conversations between theologians. You're not. You're hearing people cursing, and you think, well, what happened? Did somebody move the green, or was there an earthquake? What occurred? They're mad at the club or the ball or somebody else instead of themselves. It's about like somebody in riflery ought to say, though, it's probably the real trouble is the loose nut on the end of the stock or something. It's probably the loose nut at the end of the club that's the problem, and not the ball or the green or the course or the weather or the world in general. But without a lot of commentary on it, you know as well as I do that even in the very large nations where there are more Bibles than people, and I mean Great Britain and the United States and Australia, for all of our churches and across the length and breadth of Canada, for all of our religions, you cannot get away with walking down a public street or getting on a public conveyance with a Bible in your hand without a lot of suspicious stares. Now, a communist poster, well, people wouldn't get too excited. You see people walking along with a swastika on their arm like it's not some areas in the United States today. Or with a placard on their back, and nobody gets too excited. The stares, the hostility that you would get out of walking along with a Bible in your hand would be something else again, wouldn't it? You ever tried that just to find out? We're supposed to be a nation under God. We've even printed it on our dollar bills, which seems to be quite an appropriate place, incidentally, because that is what a lot of people worship. And yet, when you talk about God seriously, you immediately get an awful lot of squabbling and griping, and often as not, you might get Mrs. Murray excited enough to go right up to the Supreme Court with it all over again. Because we seem to be so anxious to protect the right, and we're not sure what that means anymore, of the individual, be he criminal or what, that we're going to get rid of every last little vestige of any supposed or suspected mixture of church and state, which means that any federally or state-supported school must not have even the vaguest mention of God. Now, it's all right to have the plenty of mention of evolution. It's all right to have plenty of teaching of a great religion because it is a state religion, because it is a faith, and it's a fantastic faith grounded on absolutely nothing. It's perfectly all right, according to this rather warped reasoning, that we should teach, that we should influence our children with evolution, that we should put the concept of evolution in our children's minds by the little beginning history and geology and geography and even the mathematics books. Now, you take, for example, a few very simple cases in point to all of this. Let's take a look at some of the national holidays. They are not national, but church. Some of the big holidays in the United States, Great Britain, Australia, Canada, South Africa, and around the Western so-called Christian world would be Easter, certainly St. Valentine's Day, Christmas, New Year's, and what have you. Yet, every last one of these are based on religion. But Mrs. Murray has not fought that to the Supreme Court yet. Now, the idea of a little child saying, "Now I lay me down to sleep," or "Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name," in school, that is such sheer blasphemy to the ears of an atheist that it makes them hopping mad and ready to go up to Mr. Earl Warren with their problem. But to paint pictures on the school windows of Santa Claus, a purely mythological figure, dreamed up in the ideas of a lot of people in Germany and way back in the Middle Eastern areas of the world far before that, that's something else again. The idea of a bunny, which was a pagan sex symbol because of their proliferation and because of their rapid reproductive qualities, and then the idea of an egg, and the two don't go together, they're just symbols of the same thing because all life begins in a seed or an egg. This doesn't get anybody angry. As a matter of fact, the average person would fight tooth and toenail to hang on to those customs, even though they are religious. And yet, I can tell you this, that any child who has perhaps been blessed by having parents who are objective and who are not willing to go along with the push and the press of the crowd just because others do it, and who do research and ask themselves what, where, who, when, how, and why, and they want to get to the bottom of certain questions, and they have discovered, just by the mere expediency of reading a few, maybe encyclopedias or history books on the subject, that some of the accepted customs that people observe today come from purely pagan origin. Ancient pagan Babylonians, Greeks, and Egyptians, ignorant men, as the Apostle Paul said in the book of Acts, who worshipped all kinds of gods, snakes, crawdads, crabs, all kinds of weird creatures, demons and ideas they dreamed up in their heads, and then gave them certain names and characteristics. They even had gods running around half-naked chasing each other across the heavens or coming down and having various experiences with human beings. It's in Greek mythology. And every last bit of this type of thing, derives from this ancient mythology. So here are modern, objective, up-to-the-moment parents, and they've found out, well, here are my children that are observing a custom that is nothing but sheer Babylonian mythology. And I pride myself on being emancipated from darkness and from superstition and from dumb ignorance. So I'm going to teach my children that there is no such character as Santa Claus, instead of deciding, well, it's fun for all the kiddies, like a lot of people do. Now, if such a parent were to take such a stand, in the first place, he would be about the biggest idiot in his local environment that you've ever seen. I mean, not to gather around the Tom and Jerry bowl and to sing drunken carols and to see if you can't sneak a kiss from a neighbor's wife at Christmas time. I mean, not to get at least belted with booze about once or twice a year would just about ostracize you from any normal middle-class social circle that I know of in the United States and Great Britain. The idea of not saving money for the Christmas club, the idea of not going around maybe wassailing or something of this nature, the idea of not allowing your children to participate in something like that in school, I mean, because you had seen from history, and you'd seen it proved, you decided, well, I'm objective, I'm up to the moment, I'm up to date. I would rather be modern. I'd rather start my own custom. I'm going to be an iconoclast and get out of the mainstream of the majority, and I'm going to be one of these protesting minority, because that seems to be quite popular at the moment. The more you protest, the more you become a member of a true minority, the more excited people get about it. Now, you know what would happen in the school? Well, the little child would be picked on like his classmates were suddenly turned into a pack of sharks. He would be belittled and hooted at and ridiculed and made fun of. The teacher, like as not, would give him lower grades because the little fellow would decide, I'm not going to believe in a lie. I'm just not going to. I'm merely trying to point out, then, the completely inequitable and rather insensate idea that on the one hand, we ought to kick the idea of God Almighty out of our schools. We can print it on our bills, which certainly, to me, appear to be a federal issue. Certainly appear to be something that the government sponsors. I don't know why Mrs. Murray let that escape. Maybe she didn't. Maybe she's fighting it. I haven't heard about it yet. But at any rate, it says, in God we trust, and that is from a government printing office. But yet we've got so many people who apparently are so spineless that will not stand up for what they know is right, that we meekly and docilely allow the idea of God to be kicked out of the schools. Now, as I've said in the past, I do not know what real good the idea of God in the form in which it was presented and the little parroted prayers that some few children, and few and far between they were, may have repeated in schools ever really did. And I don't know what good it really did, so I don't know just how much has been lost by it, because I don't think either you or anyone else believes that an awful lot of little children were being encouraged to lead righteous and spiritual lives merely because once a week or so a Christian worker came along and taught them a little prayer. But it just shows the rather aberration type of thinking, the vagaries and flukes of the human mind, where we don't seem to be entirely consistent all the time. Well, the Bible is a book of the chronicle of human mistakes, of humankind trying to live totally apart from is God, apart from the knowledge of God, and more today, apart from the consciousness of the very name of God. Today, where people accept with open arms the idea that God is dead, or applaud the question, who was Christ? And the Bible is the chronicle of human beings living the way that comes naturally, and ending up just the way we are today. Deepening and worsening sociological problems, deep racial tensions and hatreds as never before, horrible economic problems, burgeoning, ballooning, tremendous inflation, money getting tight, lending institutions clamping down, and maybe a huge, terrible stock market crash just around the corner, which we are being warned if it occurs, Western Europe will not escape, and any sudden shift in the political climate in Western Europe is going to mean the immediate emergence of another new totalitarian state over there, and Bible prophecy says it will occur that way. You look at the world in general, at the place to which we have come today, and there is a reason for it, and that reason is human nature. And human nature must be changed, but not through hallucinogens or drugs or alterations of genetics, but only through Almighty God and His laws and His Spirit, and only through the great master plan that Jesus Christ gave in the Gospel, in the Sermon on the Mount, in the method that Jesus said He is going to use to change human nature, because He is qualified, and He's going to do exactly that. And the Bible is a master plan that shows how it's going to be done. The Bible doesn't ask you to believe it. It says, prove me, narrowwit. It challenges you to prove whether or not the Bible is true, but it doesn't rest upon you believing it. God says, let God be true, though every man be found a liar. It doesn't matter whether the preponderance of opinion is that the Bible is not true. That does not make the Bible conveniently become untrue. It is true, nevertheless. And you can prove it by writing to these booklets on Does God Exist and the Proof of the Bible. They're free of charge. There's no price for them. Now, on this subject of human nature, you need to find out more about human nature and more about your own personal nature, what it is that makes you act and react the way you do. Now, first of all, you need to write for an article about this universal lack of self-confidence and find out why it is people are confused. They want to go to the experts for somebody else's opinion. They want to rest on someone else's advice. They don't know how to make decisions and stick with them on their own. People just don't have confidence in their lives, their marriages, their business, their jobs. They don't have confidence in religion. They don't have confidence as a college student. You need to write for this article on the universal lack of self-confidence, or just mention the article on self-confidence, and then ask for this article on This Is the Life, Abundant Living. The article on abundant living that shows you how to be happy. And this is no pull yourself up by your own bootstraps philosophy. It's practical, and it does make sense. And then a booklet we have for you on what is faith. You know, people say they wish they had more faith. Oh, millions of people believe in God. As I've said, there are more Bibles in the United States than there are people. But even though those millions believe in God, they are very quick to tell you their belief in God doesn't really pay off. It doesn't net them any definite dividends or rewards. It doesn't do anything for them because they simply don't have enough faith. They want to conjure up more. They want to know how to get some more. Well, what is faith? People don't even know what it is, and how do you get it, and how do you know if you have it? How would you sample or measure or determine whether or not you have any faith? This booklet on what is faith is absolutely free of charge. There is no price for it whatsoever. And request also this book that I announced last time on the 7 laws of success, showing you what is success and how to achieve it morally, mentally, spiritually, economically, physically, in every facet of life. Now, they're free of charge. There is no price for them. And the current number of the Plain Truth magazine will come along automatically. It's all free of charge, and there is absolutely no price for it. No follow-up, no request for money. If you send your name and address to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. That is Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. Be sure to tell us the call letters of your station. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.